Is Donald Trump a fascist or a dangerous authoritarian populist? And what's the difference? Commentator David A. Love will help us break it down. Newsflash, Donald Trump's lead in the popular vote has dropped. Trump has not won the majority of the popular votes for president, but he still has a majority of Electoral College votes. And Rafael A. Martinez grew up undocumented in the U.S., and he writes about the undocumented life he led in his new book, Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the U.S. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. While Trump, of course, still has a majority of Electoral College votes, which qualify him to sit in the Oval Office come January, but he has lost his bragging rights that, as he said on election night, that America has given us an unprecedented powerful mandate, a political victory like our country has never seen before, end quote. Well, that's not true. After the 155 million votes were finally counted, Trump ended up with less than 50% of the popular vote, 49.94% to be exact. Harris came in close behind him with 48.26%. So his margin over Harris was just a slim, just a little bit over 1%. And to put his numbers in historical perspective, his victory was anything but unprecedented or a mandate. In fact, Biden had 51.3% compared to Trump's 49.94%. Obama had 51.1% and 52.9% in his second term. George Bush had 50.7%. George H.W. Bush had 53.2%. Again, Trump had 49.94%. And Ronald Reagan garnered 58.8%. Jimmy Carter, 50.1%. And if you want to talk mandates, Richard Nixon got 60.7%. But the most impressive of all was Lyndon B. Johnson with 61.1% of the popular vote. And so why is this important? Because when Trump boasts and the Republicans that he had a mandate, somebody needs to check him. 49.94% was hardly a mandate. But nonetheless, Republicans do have a trifecta, the White House, both houses of Congress, and the Supreme Court. And Trump warned before the election that he wanted to be a dictator on day one only. But critics say he's a fascist, and his agenda is a direct threat to democracy. His supporters, of course, they say that to call him a fascist is just Democrats and liberals hating on Trump. It's going overboard to call him a fascist, dictator, authoritarian fascist. Which is he? And how will that impact our country, our policies, and the Constitution? Well, joining us in the studio this morning is David A. Love. David A. Love is a writer, a commentator, and journalism and media studies professor based in Philadelphia. He writes on politics, race, human rights, inequality, climate, and criminal justice, and has contributed to publications such as The Griot, Al Jazeera, CNN Opinion, and The Progressive. Good morning, David A. Love, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Verna. It is a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Yes, indeed. It's a pleasure to have you this morning, David. So let's narrow this list down. So a dictator, according to the dictionary, is, quote, a ruler with total power over a country, typically one who has obtained control by force. Well, we know he wanted to do that on January 6th, but that's not how he will be returning to office. So I guess we can rule out dictator on day one. But what about a dangerous authoritarian populist? That definition is someone favoring or enforcing strict obedience to the government at the expense of personal freedom. Is he perhaps an authoritarian populist, David, instead of a fascist?
Well, I would actually say he's a little bit of both. And I think that it is necessary to understand that while such individuals can take power by force, we should realize that people such as Adolf Hitler took power in Nazi Germany through an election. So I think that what is important is that what these leaders do once they get in power. And when you look at what the Republicans have planned in terms of Project 2025 and wanting to essentially gut the civil service, eliminate 50,000 people, get rid of the administrative state, concentrate power in the executive branch, and now they have power of all branches of government. They can basically do whatever they want. Trump said that he'll be a dictator on day one, doesn't have to be a dictator after that. I think the bottom line is that Trump and his party plan on taking over everything, running as much as they can through the system. And it's really up to the people ultimately to decide how much they are going to allow Trump to become an authoritarian.
Well, I did see where it was announced this morning that the door is still open for him to make recess appointments. So having that power to be able to put through his, just push through his appointments without needing congressional approval would certainly give him a considerable amount of power. According to an October 2025 ABC Ipsos poll, 49% of registered voters considered Trump to be a fascist. 29% considered Kamala Harris to be a fascist. So I don't know what that says. The definition of a fascist is an ideological term which refers to a broad set of aspirations and influences that emerged in the early 20th century, exemplified by the European dictators Benito Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, and Francisco Franco. And it includes elements of nationalism, enforcement of social hierarchies, hatreds towards social minority groups, opposition to liberalism, the cult of personality, racism, and the love of militaristic symbols. And according to the anti-fascist and socialist writer George Orwell, the term fascist oftentimes rendered meaningless in common use by its frequent use as an insult. So if we go down that list, Professor Love, let's look at nationalism, support of the interests of one's own nation to the detriment of the interests of other nations. Would you say that we could we check that box for Donald Trump? Is he a nationalist?
Oh, yes, definitely. At least in his rhetoric, with the America First concept, this idea that we have to do things for Americans. And of course, when he says Americans, he's referring specifically to white Americans because he plans on deporting 11 million undocumented immigrants who are not white. So, yeah, I would say. Definitely, nationalism falls under that.
Okay, so then we go to social hierarchies. In other words, categorizing people according to their wealth, their race, their education, their gender, their occupation, social status, or derived power. Do we check that box for Donald Trump?
Yes, certainly, because he has this politics of white grievance, where he essentially wants to bring white people back to their position of grandeur. Of course, working people, poor white people, they think that they are included in this, but they will soon find out that they are not actually part of this process because Trump is only concerned about wealthy white people.
Campaign rhetoric, perhaps, to get elected. And I thought about the so-called black jobs in that category. That would qualify him for being having social hierarchies. All right. Then the next feature is hatred towards minorities. Well, now Trump says he has a lot of black friends. Diddy, for example, Diddy is one of his friends. So can we really say that he has hatred towards minorities?
Oh, yes, because he has a long history of actually discriminating against Black people and Latinx people in terms of his policies for renting apartments and housing and things of that nature, and all of the statements that he's made. It is very obvious to me that in a white supremacist society, one can be racist and still have so-called black friends. And it is very possible for people of color, marginalized folks, to participate in white supremacy and be friends with Donald Trump. Doesn't change the fundamental structures of oppression.
And we can't forget that ad that he placed in the, I believe it was the New York Times, against the five young men at the time. For the killing, for the rape of the woman in Central Park. And next on the list, opposition to liberalism. Well, we know how he feels. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, yes, definitely. He is definitely opposed to liberalism and is going to do whatever he can to eliminate the entire legacy of, you know, from FDR and the Johnson administration. And, you know, we have to be concerned that our basic civil rights, voting rights, which are already eroded, but will be further eroded, reproductive freedom, so many things that they're going to try to eliminate, press freedom. So yeah, definitely.
And also, it's almost as though liberals have been identified as the enemy within within the country. And so therefore, you know, he's criminalized liberalism. Then there's the cult of personality. Now, does he fit that description? I think. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. Definitely a cult of personality. The Republican Party is now the Trump Party, and no particular policy proposals except for, you know, a lot of harmful things. But first and foremost, the underlying theme is that people have to be obedient and worship Trump. So, yeah, it's definitely a cult of personality.
Kiss his ring. We've seen some, unfortunately, some media has started to line up. And then racism and love, and I think we've already gone over the racism portion, love of militaristic symbols. I don't know that, help me out. I don't know that he's really demonstrated any love for militaristic symbols. He's demonstrated a love for the military and the use of the military.
Yes, and I mean, when you look at it, ultimately both parties embrace military. I don't know if he has any particular edge on that. He is talking about, you know, wanting to crack down on Iran. I know that he does favor military dictators, but. You know, one could argue that Biden and the Democrats are just as militaristic. We're in the middle of an empire right now, a declining empire.
Yes. And so, all in all, David A. Love, do you feel comfortable identifying Trump as a fascist?
Yes, I do. But I would also like to say that people think that fascism is something that is new to this country and is arriving. For people of African descent, for indigenous people, the fascism has been here for quite some time, meaning centuries. The fact that indigenous people were genocided, thrown off their land, and then African people were shipped in, kidnapped to work the land. We have known fascism for a very long time. And now the difference is that now white folks will soon find out what fascism is all about.
Oh, well, so how so? I mean, what immediate threats concern you about Trump's second term? What about the cabinet members he's putting in place? Any thoughts there?
Yes, there is a term called caucusocracy, which basically means government by the worst people, incompetent people. And one trait of fascism is to have all of these incompetent people running government, because the whole idea is, you know, your obedience. And so just based on that, it's going to be a big mess. And having people like Dr. Oz to head Medicare and Medicaid, what are we doing here? To have Robert F. Kennedy in charge of HHS. That alone concerns me greatly. And all of these Fox News hosts and others who are going to be in charge of these departments and agencies. It's a very unserious proposition, and a lot of damage can be done, I think, very quickly.
Now, what do you call that? What's that term you used?
Yes, caucusocracy or caucusocracy. Rule by the worst people, by bad people, incompetent people. And that's what we're seeing now, in addition to, you know, authoritarianism, oligarchy, all of the bad things. And we will soon find out what that all means. I think ultimately people must remember that we should not obey in advance.
Good point. We're going to go back to that. When you mentioned RFK, he's going to be the Department of Health and Human Services, the head of the Health and Human Services. It's interesting. There are reports that he had a worm eating away at his brain. And I don't know how publicized that has become, but it's interesting that now he's going to be the head of the Department of Health and Human Services. He also announced that he's going to be scaling back the nation's reliance on Ozempic, the drug that many Americans are using to control their weight. He's claiming that Americans hooked on that drug are, quote, stupid and addicted. So that's kind of what we can look forward to with RFK. But, you know, what about Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel? Huckabee, of course, is an evangelical Christian who has previously expressed his belief that God granted historic Palestine to the modern state of Israel, is a strong advocate for Israel's expansion in the occupied West Bank, which he refers to as Judea and Samaria. He also has a close relationship with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And of course, Israeli settlers are just rejoicing at Huckabee's appointment. I'm wondering what millions of Arab Americans and Muslims who voted for Trump, what they're feeling right now, if they're getting any of that buyer's remorse. Your thoughts about that, David A. Love?
I am sure there's a lot of buyer's remorse. I can understand the frustration of many Arab and Muslim Americans considering this year of genocide of the Palestinians and the failure, unwillingness of the Biden administration to do anything. So now we're in a situation where you have Huckabee, who is, as you mentioned, an evangelical Christian, some of the most fervent supporters of Zionism, and they're just gonna allow Israel to do whatever they want, as if they're not already. But it's going to mean, I think, unimpeded, Israel will just be able to incorporate the West Bank and Gaza into Israel. And this is exactly what the Christian evangelicals want. So Huckabee is bad news, and it's already the whole thing has been bad news for quite some time.
So then we go to Elon Musk, who incidentally and kind of oddly showed up in the family photo. And Trump's wife, Melania, wasn't even in the photo. But there was Elon Musk, right alongside the others, to the point where some have started to say he's the first lady because of his over-involvement or his, constant presence at Mar-a-Lago. And his deep involvement in the upcoming Trump administration. He has been put in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency, and he's already decided that Medicaid and the SNAP program will be targeted in order to pay for Trump's 2017 tax cut plan that he put in place back then, and they want to get it continued during this administration. Any thoughts about Elon Musk and his involvement, David?
Yes, the presence of Elon Musk in this election and in this administration, this future administration, I think really highlights the problem of money in politics and having these billionaires, these oligarchs controlling our government, because that's basically what they're doing. Particularly South African apartheid billionaires like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, who bankrolls JD Vance. These people are going to come in and basically control the government through their re Republican puppets. And the larger issue is that these billionaires are controlling all of the politicians and controlling all of the policy. So now they are just able to step in, use the government as their own piggy bank. And that leaves regular working and poor people helpless.
So some other considerations under a fascist, I don't want to say regime, but under a fascist-led government. Well, let me just say, after General Mark Milley said that Trump would start persecuting his political opponents if he won the 2024 presidential election, Trump suggested that Milley should be executed for treason. And Trump has repeatedly voiced support for outlawing political dissent and criticism he considers misleading or challenges his claims to power. Republican Representative Paul Gosar further stated that in a better society, quote, sodomy promoting General Milley would be hung, unquote. So retired General Barry McCaffrey said regarding Trump's statements that what we are seeing is a parallel to the 1930s in Nazi Germany. Trump's formal policy plan for a second term, Agenda 47, has been characterized as fascist. Historian Ruth Ben-Ezeat stated that the similarities between the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 and Mussolini's laws for the defense of the state, which transformed Italy into a repressive regime, are striking, citing the elimination of judicial independence and the strengthening of executive authority. So, How Democracies Die, author Daniel Ziblatt said that Trump's combined employment of false allegations against his political opponents and allusions of retribution by American patriots is similar to tactics used by Venezuela's Hugo Chavez in 1930s and European fascists. An analyst by NPR, I'm sorry, an analysis by NPR, National Public Radio, found that between 2022 and October 2024, Trump has made more than 100 threats to investigate, prosecute, imprison, or otherwise punish his perceived opponents. So Trump's Project 2025 seeks to defund public radio and public television. NPR and Pacifica are named in the plan for defunding. But that really won't affect Pacifica because we don't get government funding anyway. So if they defund it, it won't. We rely on the generosity and support of our listeners. But could President-elect Trump use the military within the U.S. to suppress protests on college campuses, Professor Love, patrol the southern border, and conduct mass deportations? I saw on the news this morning that he has said he will use the military to end the massive deportations by invoking the Insurrection Act, the little-known law that grants the president sweeping authority to deploy the military on American soil, and he plans to do this. That, is it possible to take steps now to ensure that the law does not become basically Trump's most dangerous weapon? What are your thoughts about that?
I believe that he will try to use the military to suppress dissent, to go after protesters. And the fact that there is this plan, this executive order to fire all of the generals, that tells you a lot of what we need to know, because, you know, if he is able to disrupt the military command, eliminate the leadership in the military and replace them with loyalists, then I suppose he could do whatever he wants. Ultimately, if his party is in control of the entire government, and, you know, in a country where wealthy white men have no consequences for their actions, you know, in any other country, he would have been cast out of the country, much less wouldn't be allowed to serve again. He would be in exile. But because of Merrick Garland's inaction and slow rolling, Trump is here again. And I suppose he can do whatever he wants, but it's up to people to stop them. And I'm sure people are starting to organize now to avoid the mass deportations and the other reckless actions that he has planned.
Well, a couple of points. He did try to, he wanted to deploy the military forces to quash the Black Lives Matter protests, but was convinced not to by advisors such as Attorney General William Barr and General Mark Milley. In his second term, with Trump pledging to purge independent voices and install loyalists across the government, there may be no one left to say no. So we could see that. But all is not lost. The Biden administration and Congress have roughly 2 months to reform this dangerous law before Trump returns to office. And experts across the political spectrum have proposed crucial reforms. Congress could explicitly narrow the specific substantive circumstances in which the act can be invoked, eliminate the private militia provisions. And that's really kind of dangerous, because the provision currently says that he could use the deployment of regular troops and federalizing the National Guard. And the act permits the president to deputize private militias. So in theory, Trump could grant federal law enforcement authority to those extremist groups who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, or to militant organizations like the Proud Boys. So, but the Biden administration has 2 months to at least take that out of that law. So we have a lot to look forward to. And as you said, this is not the first time we have lived under a fascist government. David A. Love, Rutgers University professor, commentator on topics of politics, race, human rights, inequality, criminal justice, and Gaza. He's contributed to the Griot, Al Jazeera, CNN Opinion, and The Progressive. Professor Love, thank you for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you for having me. It has been great talking with you.
Any final thoughts, briefly, as we close out?
Well, most of all, I would say that we have a lot ahead of us, a lot of work to do. There is time to mourn, and we must do that, but we must also organize. And in solidarity, there's strength.
David A. Love. Up next, 15 million Americans have at least one undocumented family member living with them. Author Rafael A. Martinez was undocumented. We'll get his reaction to Trump's mass deportation plans and more when we come back.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a town hall meeting on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon to 2:30 p.m. Plenty of off-street parking is available. As this will be our last town hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
And welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, Rafael A. Martinez came to the U.S. with his parents as a young child in the midst of 9/11. He's currently an assistant professor of Southwest Borderlands at Arizona State University and the author of Illegalized, Undocumented Youth Movements in the U.S. He's a recipient of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Good morning, Professor Martinez. Thank you for joining us on What's at Stake.
Good morning, Berna. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. So you are a recipient of DACA. So explain to our listeners what legal protection that actually affords you.
Yeah, so DACA was an executive action under President Obama's administration in 2012, in June of 2012. And it gave undocumented youth like myself authority to have a work permit and have protection from deportation, and it's a renewable contract, if you will. Every 2 years, you have to petition or renew your DACA. And since 2017, under the 45th president, it was sent to the Supreme Court. So since 2017, we haven't had the opportunity for new applicants or young people between the ages of 15 to 30 who could be new applicants to apply for the program. And so it's been blocked and held up, and it's in a precarious situation at the moment. At the height of the program, about 800,000 people were signed onto the program. Currently, it's at about 500,000 people that are still signed up for DACA. And that's just the number in comparison to the larger 11 million immigrant undocumented population in the United States.
So that's not a permanent status. It has to be renewed every 2 years. And apparently there's some ruling that's going to be made by the First Circuit Court of U.S. coming up this year. What ruling is that? What are they ruling on? Whether or not to continue the program?
Yeah, in some ways they're ruling on the legality of the program. If, you know, the president had authority to, you know, basically do an executive action on federal immigration policy. It's already had, you know, inclination. The court has already had inclination that there was no legality to do this. But then the ruling is basically to keep the program or continue the program. The rulings have dragged on for quite a bit of time. And, you know, the question is that the public opinion of the U.S. Population shows favorable, appreciation for undocumented youth, in particular for DACA recipients who have been contributors in big numbers to this country. And so a ruling of ending the program would definitely not be seen favorable by the general American public.
Okay, so you're a recipient of DACA. You received DACA because you were a child when your family arrived from Mexico, but your parents were adults. Do they have legal protection from deportation?
So that's part of the issue with DACA is that, you know, when it was introduced, you had to be within the ages of 15 to 30. So parents or adults did not qualify or age out into the program. However, luckily, my parents are now residents of the U.S. My younger sister is a U.S. born citizen, We are what we call a mixed status families. That includes undocumented or mixed status family members, as well as U.S. citizen children as part of that household. And so when my sister turned 21, my parents were able to petition for them, and they are now U.S. residents, which is a level of protection, and ideally will become U.S. citizens as well to have even more protection and rights and be able to vote in this country.
So this new person that Trump has put in charge, Thomas Homan, he has basically said that in families where there are mixed status people, that the undocumented would be deported. And when asked specifically if he was concerned that, you know, families would be separated, he said, well, no, I'm not concerned about that. Send them all back. Your reaction to that?
Again, I'll point to something that Professor David A. Love mentioned a while ago in your segment. You know, the question I returned back to the U.S. public is, are we going to stand for that type of militarized government and fascism? Because it all comes down to not only undocumented immigrants being impacted by such actions that are being proposed, but again, U.S. children in the millions are going to be impacted. And one of the definitions that I began to expand in my own work is the idea that we're not just mixed status families, but we're mixed status community members. And what that means is you're talking about millions of people being ripped apart from the economy, from their communities, from the social public sphere. And when you're talking about the level of impact that that's going to create, it's gigantic. And so the question goes back to the U.S. public. Are folks going to allow that to happen to their neighbors, to their community members, to their school parents? I mean, you name it, the list goes on. The level of impact is going to be felt at every single level. And most importantly, it's going to be felt by U.S. economy, U.S. public sphere. And so it's not just going to be something that impacts, you know, undocumented communities.
Give us an example of that, Rafael. What exactly, how do you see, give us some specifics. Everybody's concerned about the price of eggs when they go to the grocery store. Is the deportation is going to have any impact on our economy in that regard, and foods that we have access to, et cetera?
I pose those same rhetorical questions. Who picks those eggs? Who fosters those that meat? Who fosters the agriculture that runs this country? It's undocumented laborers. And so we have to ask those questions, because if you're talking about impact of economy, it's going to have those impacts directly on U.S. economy if those things are not running efficiently and you don't have Americans who are going to do those jobs. I'll give you a perfect example. In 2016 and 2017, there was these national immigrant marches that took over and became some of the largest demonstrations that some of these cities like LA, New York, Chicago have seen to date in history. Millions of people took to the streets to protest H.R. 4437, which would have further criminalized undocumented immigrants in this country. And, you know, undocumented immigrants and allies came out of the shadows to say, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to allow this. The other call to action for that particular mobilization effort was, we're not going to spend any money on that particular day to show people the level of impact that immigrants have in this country. And, you know, economists showed that millions of dollars were lost on just one single day, May 1st, 2006. Right. So the idea, if immigrants were to just disappear from this economy, what impact that would do to the U.S. economy would just be tremendous, and it would be felt at every single level.
So some Latinos were not happy with the choices that they had in the recent election. Vice President Kamala Harris was connected to former President Barack Obama's administration, who was known disparagingly by immigrants as the deporter in chief. And then you had on the other side, Donald Trump, who painted immigrants as rapists, criminals, unlawful dog eating, job stealing immigrants. So for some, it was a difficult choice. What was your reaction to the election, Professor Martinez?
I was disappointed to see Latinx community, but also other impacted marginalized communities, you know, vote in favorable outcomes for the 47th president, because we saw that essentially people were thinking of their choices as single issue choices, right? And they were voting across single issues. And, you know, our Black feminists and you know, scholars remind us that we don't live single issue lives. We live complex identities and complex relationships. And as Professor David A. Love also said in the last segment, I think that a lot of white folks will find out what fascism is all about and pretty soon what marginalized communities have been saying and feeling for a long time. And those folks who voted for the 47th president will come to recognize, oh, maybe the economy gets better. I don't think it is, but maybe the economy gets better. But what about the school that my child went to? Now I have to pay for privatized education. Like, I'm in education. I'm thinking about those things for my own children, right? So what happens to all the other issues that then comes to hit the fan for many of these folks who voted? And also, again, going back to the idea that immigration and deportation is something that hits close to home for not only the Latinx community, but the U.S. general public. And so I think a lot of people are come to realize the impact of the decisions they've made pretty soon.
Well, you know, Latino men represented the largest shift towards Trump in the 2024 election, despite the fact that Trump promised to conduct this massive deportation, you know, once he's in office. And looks like with the appointment of Thomas Homan, he's preparing to follow through on that campaign promise. Why do you, were you surprised at the sudden shift in Trump among to Trump among Latino men? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I attribute that to patriarchy, to sexism, and you know, those are things that our communities are who have been oppressed and under oppression for such a long time. They feel that they, if they align themselves closest to white supremacy or white privileges, that they will be afforded such privileges as men who are expected to lead their household, right? And the reality is, again, that those things are not going to trickle down for, you know, people of color and for marginalized communities. I'll also remind your audience that, you know, in Mexico right now, we have a woman president. Right. In Latin America, we've already had women presidents.
So what happened to that patriarchy that many have alluded to, not just you, but many have alluded to? There's a woman president in Mexico.
And that speaks to the level of you know, the guise of the American dream, the guise of promise. But it, again, it requires people of color to subscribe to these actions to feel the level of protection. Right, to feel the level of garnishing that protection, when in reality that's just a guise, it's just false. But you know, people subscribe to that, people buy into that. They will rather, you know, continue to uphold those patriarchal, you know, norms rather than, you know, wanting to make those shifts that can be part of their own liberation. And I think that there's a level of you know, of impact of education, people just not being logical, aware, and you know, there's a level of anti-intellectualism in part of those conversations as well. And I think that academics like myself and other folks need to not be part of the problem, but need to speak directly to our communities as a way to unite and bring people together.
Now, so as a DACA recipient, Professor Martinez, what were the expectations of you growing up in the U.S.?
Well, like most immigrant families, the idea was we came here for a better life. And I think that, you know, I've lived up to that standard, you know, in terms of, you know, going all the way to getting my PhD, becoming a professor. And part of my positionality is to show people not what I can do, that I'm exceptional by any means of the imagination, but that what happens when you open a pathway for immigrant populations in this country, the idea of hyper documentation, you offer ways of documenting which open pathways and create a pathway access for our undocumented youth. is exactly changing their individual lives, their material lives, but also those of their families and their communities, right? Because it's now, I'm now teaching U.S. history to U.S. citizen children in American colleges, right? And, you know, my book, my research has allowed me to do that and build a critical consciousness for youth in this country. And so I think my experience should tell people, not that I'm exceptional, but that, you know, this is what can be possible for undocumented immigrants and communities that are facing oppression if you create a pathway, you know, to success or really material change in this country.
Well, let me first say congratulations on all your success. I didn't realize you were a doctor, so we should be addressing you as Dr. Martinez. But, you know, at one point you grew tired of being this model citizen to prove youth self-deserved, to basically prove yourself deserving of citizenship. Did that give birth to any activism on your part?
Certainly. You know, the book that I write, Illegalized Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States, is precisely all about that. It's, you know, when I encounter the social movements of undocumented youth who were my peers, people of my generation, who were doing activism that wanted to change the rhetoric of saying, let's catch in the visibility that undocumented youth have tarnished in this country from the first decade of the 2000s. Under the DREAM Act, which would have been a pathway to citizenship for undocumented youth, that unfortunately never passed. When that did not pass, undocumented youth realized that they needed to mobilize in different recourse, which was civil disobedience, taking a page out of the history book from, you know, the civil rights movement and saying we need to put pressure on the government to be able to, you know, bring about real change and reform. That's when we had DACA in 2012. All the organizing efforts led to something like DACA to be possible. And then that they exchanged that visibility to bring that attention to the larger 11 million undocumented immigrants who continue to be pushed in the shadows and not having that same level of visibility and protection. So the same thing for me happened is, you know, beyond the research and work that I've been doing, I've been active in our communities that I've lived in, but also working with families, working with students. Now in my role as an educator is mentoring students, bringing awareness to the campuses and making pathways, like I mentioned earlier, for undocumented students, immigrant students, but also students of color and other marginalized communities, as well as all students, right? Because this is supporting all the students that we can at capacity.
So do you think that it was worth the risk? There were risks being taken, were there not, if you were engaging in civil disobedience, when, whereas part of your being able to qualify to keep your DACA was to stay out of so-called trouble. The civil rights community called that good trouble. How risky was that? Do you think it was worth it? Have you really gotten anything concrete as a result of that?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, the public, you know, sphere has been important in the movement for immigrant rights and undocumented youth. And I say that because, you know, the escalation and visibility cultural capital that undocumented youth garnished through the 2000s is what gave them the opportunity to take these risks and not be detained or deported in most occasions, or all the occasions that I write about in the book. Nobody was detained and deported for the most part. And what happened was that, you know, they were looking at, again, civil rights examples. And earlier you were talking about the military and, you know, the call to the military. And let's not forget Vietnam, for example, era where, you know, there was conscientious objectors that took sanctuary in churches or places of worships so that they would not be, you know, called to serve on the military. That's literally where the sanctuary movement for immigrant rights began in the 1980s in this country. And so in some ways, you know, undocumented youth were looking at that and saying that it would be highly unfavorable, not by the U.S. government, but the U.S. public, to be able to do these actions in certain places and against certain individuals that are seen favorable from the U.S. public. And so I think a lot of that banked on this idea. Now, with this new administration coming up, that's going to beg the question, right? And again, it goes back to the general public of what they're willing to tolerate. And they might be coming for some of us, but eventually they're going to be coming for all of us. And how much are we willing to tolerate, you know, from the U.S. public side of things for those things to happen?
Well, a couple of things. As a professor, you may have considered the fact that under Project 2025, what you're going to be able to teach could be drastically restricted. But in your book, you also suggest that with all the costs that come with being undocumented, it actually has some advantages. Can you expound on those for us, Dr. Martinez?
Yeah, well, you know, many scholars, including myself, have been talking about this idea of undocumented resilience, right? And that's the thing that when, you know, pressure measures, you know, pound on our communities, it forces our community members to be resilient, to be creative, and to figure out different actions. I'll give you a quick example. All through my, schooling, and now as a professor, I often get the compliment, a simple one, of saying, you're so organized, you're so, you know, you're always on top of things and very scheduled. And I said, yeah, when you have to plan your life according to these immigration batches and these different, you know, schedules and different timelines, you kind of have to be, right? So you're forced to be resilient. But I'm always telling people that resilience is a double-edged sword, right? There's the positive attributes and the planning that comes with that. But there's also the trauma, the PTSD, and the mental health issues that we also carry for generations and we pass on to generations. And I think that's really the detrimental thing that we're seeing with this current state is that people need to remember this is going to be felt for generations because our kids are absorbing everything that is going on. They're hearing it in the schools. They're hearing it in the playgrounds. And those things are stress and trauma that our kids and earlier generations are going to carry with them moving forward into their adulthood.
And so how are these threats or promises of mass deportation landing in the community, Dr. Martinez?
Yeah, I could say that both, you know, undocumented immigrants and allies alike and organizations, organizers are preparing, you know, and they're preparing for worst case scenarios. They're preparing for, you know, different levels of scenarios. Luckily, I do believe that, and as my book shows, is that, you know, there's decades of organizing efforts now that prepare us in thinking about networks of, you know, it almost feels like late slavery times in some ways, and not to compare and saying that they're the same thing, but like you need networks of support and care of people who are willing to, you know, put themselves, you know, in line with authorities to be able to, you know, step in or intervene in supporting the process. And the other thing I'll say is that the plepon actions, right, immigration courts in the U.S. today are already impacted and don't have enough personnel, staff, to be able to support the court cases that we're seeing today, let alone, you know, the idea of processing 11 million cases of people who are up for deportation. Because, you know, one thing is, are we going to allow due process for in human rights, or are we going to allow human rights violations to happen under these deportation practices? That's when the world also intervenes and the world looks at the U.S. as a human rights violation case study.
So now, briefly, in the few couple of minutes that we have left, why did your family leave Mexico? And I know your story is not every story. Okay, being told that we don't have to, you know, just wind your family very quickly. We just have about a minute left.
Well, one thing is true. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. But one thing that is true is that immigration is always going to continue to happen because of the way that U.S. Intervention has happened around the world. People are going to want to come to the United States. That is going to continue true. How the American public responds to that is important.
Okay, Dr. Rafael A. Martinez, Assistant Professor of Southwest Borderlands at Arizona State University and the author of Illegalized Undocumented Youth Movements in the United States. Thank you for joining us this morning on What's at Stake.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, the listener. for joining us. You are, of course, our raison d'etre. Thank you to our engineer extraordinaire, Michael Nasella. We're out of time, but stay right here. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Fay Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in words of the late, great Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done.